I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
You can find a dose of enlightenment in the most unexpected places. The Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh taught that just going for a walk can be a kind of meditation. The Nova Scotia artist Deanne Fitzpatrick says it's the same thing with hooking rugs.
I find that walking and hooking rugs takes me to the same place that I imagine someone who's doing a sitting meditation wants to go.
One of Deanne's traditions is choosing a word for every new year, a word she will try to embody as the year goes on. In 2022, that word was steep.
The intention was like you put the tea bag in the cup and you leave it and it gets stronger. But you don't always have to be rooting at it. And so what I was trying to do that year was to try and steep myself and appreciate what I already have, what I already know, and the things that I was already carrying with me.
On today's episode, Deanne Fitzpatrick is checking in on you. She wants to make sure you never utter the phrase, "I'm not creative," or "I'm not artistic." Yes, you are, Fitzpatrick says, whether you know it or not. Creativity is baked into being human.
I feel that what's in control is the spirit, really. It's your little art spirit. Like, everybody has that inside them. Some of us use it and some of us don't. And sometimes I look at a rug and I feel like, well, that really came through you more than you actually made it.
The artist in wool, Deanne Fitzpatrick, coming up. Later this hour, forget the bucket list. Meet the guy who's proposing a goodbye tour instead.
When I think about, the limited time I have on Earth, give a thought to what, is really part of your daily life, part of your fabric, part of what's wormed its way into your heart.
Living well from beginning to end. Today on Tapestry, I'm Mary Hines. Before Deanne Fitzpatrick discovered rug hooking, she had planned to become a therapist. These days, the therapy comes from the act of creating, from making things with her own two hands. A solo show of Deanne's work, called The Very Mention of Home, is currently on display at the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia. Her work is also in the permanent collections of the Canadian Museum of History and the Art Gallery of Newfoundland. Deanne Fitzpatrick is my guest. Hello to you.
Hello, Mary. How are you today?
Well, I'm fine, and thanks for being here. I've been wanting to speak to you for a while.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to it, too.
You know, there's a theme I've noticed a lot in your writing, Deanne. It's this idea that wanting to make the world around you more beautiful is okay. That's a worthwhile thing to be doing. Tell me about your thinking here. Why does beauty matter?
I know beauty isn't everything, but sometimes it's just enough, It's sometimes it's all you need. I think when we see something beautiful, we know it, and it makes us feel differently about what, about the world around us. I think sometimes, when you're an artist, you're kind of convinced that beauty isn't enough, that just to make something beautiful, it's maybe a little bit trite, or not important enough or not thoughtful enough. And somewhere about midway through making rugs, I just said, if I can make it beautiful, gosh, I'll take it. Like, I'll take that. That's good enough for me.
You didn't see yourself as an artist when you were growing up. And I think that kind of surprised me. When you were a kid, you didn't set out to become an artist. Where did it take hold for you? How did it take hold?
It only took hold when I learned how to hook rugs. Like, I think I always was, I always had some qualities that were a bit aggravating, probably to others.
Sure. aggravating.
Aggravating to others. And I think that that was always the little artist in me that was like too curious, too nosy, wanting bored, wanting to fidget. You know what I mean? Wanting to make something and do with their hands. So I probably always had that. But I never really identified it until this woman taught me how to hook a loop and to make rugs. And then through that making, I found like my own voice and my own story as an artist, I suppose. I had hoped to be a therapist. That was my intention. I was working as a counselor, and that was really what I was thinking about. When I grew up in Newfoundland in the 1970s, I didn't know any artists. There, you know, there was a woman who was a nun who used to go out and paint a little bit on the track where we lived. And that to me was, you know, it just seemed odd, really.
Well, I was so taken with this idea that you set out to be a therapist, that this was the path you were on. And you mentioned in one of your books, you're pretty sure you're helping people more by doing what you're doing right now. Tell me about rug hooking as a way of putting something good out into the world, your path now easily being equal to what it would have been had you become a therapist.
Yeah, I think so. I believe that myself. Like, I just feel that when people learn how to express themselves and when they spend time making, it takes you back to yourself, you know? And when you spend, like, if you're going to make a rug, it takes hours, right? I suppose it's no different if you were knitting a sweater, right? You sit with yourself, and in sitting with yourself, you know, it's contemplative. You're thinking about your relationships. You're thinking about your people. You're thinking about who you love, and you're thinking about the way, you know, eventually you're doing it so long, eventually you start to think about the way you think, really. And that's always key to sort of growing. And the other thing, you know, is that there's so much community around craft and around making and around rug hooking in particular. People gather to do it. So whether it's the actual like motion of hand over hand and the repetitive rhythm of something and what that does to you as a human being, or whether is it that it connects you with a community of like-minded people, I don't know, but I've watched it time and time again and I've seen it myself. But mostly I've heard the stories from women particularly who've used it as a means to help their losses or their grief or the changes that they've had in their life. Or time and time again, people have said to me, this really made a difference for me. And I know personally, it's made a difference for me.
How has it changed you?
Well, I think it's made me calmer and kinder because it's made me slow down and made me more reflective. When you're making something, like when you're making a rug, half the time, I think I know where I'm going. And initially, when I was hooking rugs years ago, I kind of knew where I was going. You know, I had an idea and a pattern. But now, a lot of times when I'm making rugs, I'm just lost. So I think it's made me more patient to make something and have it not work out and think, well, I spent a month on that, you know. This is what I got. And it's not that great, you know?
But can you take that in stride? That would drive me crazy working on something for a month and having it be, you know.
Yeah, I can take it in stride now. I didn't like it at first because I was really well more, like I was planning more and I was color planning and I was thinking about things and I had, you know, really straightforward kinds of patterns. But now sometimes, you know, I've got, I don't know, hundreds of colors in a great big 5x6 piece. And I'm just kind of hoping for the best, you know. It's an act of faith making, really.
Is it as though in the early days you were trying to control it? You were trying to be in control?
Oh, I was right in control of it, you know.
and that's not so much the way you work now. Is the rug in control now? What's in control now?
Oh, well, I don't know what's in control now. I think it's about letting go. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing that I've learned. And that's another way that it's changed me. And that's almost just coming to me now as we talk, really. But yes, I'm able to let go. I feel that what's in control is the spirit, really, is your little art spirit. Like, everybody has that inside them. Some of us use it and some of us don't. But I feel like that's what's working. That's, you know, that spirit.
I love this idea that everybody does have that little art spirit inside them, because I found that so striking. You were given an honorary degree last spring at Mount St. Vincent University. Congratulations, Dr. Deanne. And one of the first things you said in your commencement speech was, this was to the students, please stop saying you're not creative. And I have so many questions about this. Number one, why is that the default position for so many of us? This insisting that, well, other people are artists, other people might be creative or talented, but that's certainly not me.
You know, it's not as negative as it used to be, but I think we can't really quantify it. We don't know really what it is. So I think that it's not something that we can define easily in ourselves. I mean, truthfully, I don't think before I found that I could write and that I could make rugs, I don't think I saw it in myself. But my friend says, you know, it takes creativity to live, really. It does. It takes creativity to get up in the morning, and because a day is a day. It's like the same day every day unless you do something with it. We all have this beautiful well inside us that we can tap into. And, you know, we may not be able to draw. And I think creativity, too, is associated with drawing, which is a beautiful, wonderful technical skill. And when I was a child, I sort of learned that other people could draw better than me. And that made me think that maybe I shouldn't bother drawing. So I think a lot of people that I end up working with associate creativity with drawing. And to me, they're really very different things. Creativity is about problem solving. Like, you know, like I think computer technicians and people who write programs and stuff, they're very creative.
Yeah. You mentioned this phrase and I keep seeing it in your books and in your newsletters, hand over hand, you know, to describe the kind of soothing aspect of rug hooking. And this isn't a craft I've ever done, so I don't really know what that means. When you talk about the meditative nature of hand over hand, take me through what that means physically. What are you doing?
So I'm holding a piece of cloth or yarn in one hand underneath my linen or burlap, and in the other hand, I'm holding a hook. So I'm taking the hook and putting it down through the linen, and I'm lifting up the piece of string, essentially, right? And then after I bring the first end up, I'm bringing up loop by loop by loop by loop. And you can even hear the thrumming in the sound of my voice now, loop by loop by loop. One hand is over another. And a lot of times when you're making anything, it's about the hands working together. And so that's what it is. But the sound itself is a very meditative sound. It's a plop, 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 plop.
You've talked about creativity as a kind of birthright, you know, something I might have simply because I'm a human being. What's it like when you're teaching rug hooking and you see the penny drop for someone, when you see them talk back to a lifetime of thinking, well, I'm not creative, I'm not an artist, I don't know how to, I'm not one of the chosen elect. What's it like when you see them all of a sudden think, I'm doing the thing. I there is this wellspring of creativity in me, and I'm seeing it for the first time.
To me, it's like they just set themselves free, right? And then they start seeing things differently. I hear that time and time again, like green doesn't become green anymore. It becomes moss and ivy, and, you know, they see all the colors in the grass. I don't know. They just open up.
There was a really striking moment in that commencement speech of yours. Mm-hmm. You were talking about sugar maple trees and maple syrup time, and you made the point that it's only when the tree is wounded that it can be tapped. It's only when the cut goes in that the sweet stuff comes out. Have you seen that in your own life, something good coming out of something painful?
Oh, I think so. I think we've all seen that. I'm not suggesting that the pain is always worth it. I mean, some losses are so deep that I have no understanding of. But yes, I think time and time again that through being hurt or through being alone, we learn the value of being together. You know, I have in my life. I think in my mid-40s, I had a very, very difficult time. I was having trouble sleeping. I just felt really, really uncertain. And I think getting through that time has made me a better person, but it's also made me a better artist, you know? I think that was part of letting go, you know? That's part of why I can now just spend a week on a rug and say, okay, what's going to happen here?
There's a tradition that comes up every so often on Tapestry, and it's this idea of choosing a word for the year. Some people do it at New Year's, but you don't have to. And one year, I think this might have been 2022, your word was steeped, as in making tea. And as you know, I'm someone who has the kettle on all day long, or I'm at, you know, Tim Hortons getting steeped tea. I found something really powerful in that word. What was on your mind? What were you hoping for when you chose steeped as kind of your guiding idea for the year?
I don't know that I did that great a job that year. Just
well,
saying.
Okay.
But
the intention was there. Well, you set the intention.
The intention was there. And the intention was like, you put the tea bag in the cup and you leave it and it gets stronger. But you don't always have to be rooting at it. And so what I was trying to do that year was to try and steep myself and appreciate what I already have, what I already know. Instead of, like, I'm someone who's, I think that's a, it's the story of a maker. We're always trying to refine and make things better. And I did try to do that. And I do think about it. And I think that, like, sometimes we neglect what we already know, what's already there. So that's what I was trying to do.
You're with Tapestry. Thanks for inviting us in. Whether it's on podcast, on CBC Listen, or on CBC Radio 1. If you're listening online at cbc.ca/tapestry, hello to you. I'm Mary Hines. My guest is the Nova Scotia rug hooker, Deanne Fitzpatrick. Maybe the best way to describe Fitzpatrick is in her own words. Quote, I'm a lot of things in no particular order. A mother, sister, wife, artist, writer, teacher, reader, thinker, talker, friend, fool, dreamer, buddy. I am good at all of these. I am also terrible at all of these because sometimes I am being one of them when I really want to be one of the others. You write a newsletter every week, Sunday Letters. Sometimes they're about making things, rug hooking, art, creativity. Mostly they're about what it means to be human, right? And I was really struck by something you wrote. Contentment is just so underrated. Why is the world always trying to sell me on some kind of wild bliss? Tell me what you're thinking here. What was on your mind when you thought contentment is really good and I wish more people would acknowledge that?
Well, really, when you're content, like you got everything right then in that moment, you're not looking on social media or you're not looking at the neighbor's new car or whatever it is. Like when you're content, you got everything. You know you got everything. You got it. Like that's what we're striving for, is to feel good. And contentment gives you that. And sometimes, like, I love that when I feel that in my own yard, you know, instead of thinking I need to be somewhere else or doing something. And I feel personally, Mary, I don't know about you, but I feel a lot of pressure to travel, to do interesting things, to be interesting. You know, I like there's a lot of social pressure these days for those things. And a lot of times I find myself really happy on my own step. Not always. Sometimes I just got to get out of here, you know? But I think like contentment is really underrated. And we are told that we need the experience, the thing, you know? And it used to be things, and now experiences are really built up and they are important. But I don't think most of us can truly get to live a life of one experience after another, right? And sometimes we have to be in our own yards, in our own houses, at our own kitchen tables. So contentment with what we have, or knowing what knowing what you got. And I remember years ago listening to Peter Zowski, and this woman was on, and she said, it's not what you got, it's how you keep it, right? And that really, that really struck with me. So I think when we're content, we're keeping things well. Now, I'm not always content. I would never say that. I am a person who strives and struggles and just like anybody else, right? But when I have it, I think maybe that is bliss.
Well, I love the way you poke fun at, you know, the ad campaigns, the marketing, the social media. The bliss part of this picture is you are literally in France. You're at a chateau with a long wooden table and your gorgeous your friends are all around you and, you know, French linen and white dishes and everybody's clinking glasses and laughing. And you know, you talked about how, like, who gets to live like that? That maybe should not be the what we're striving for. Maybe that's not what bliss is.
Maybe it isn't. Well, a few weeks after I wrote that letter, sometimes people write back to me, right? A few weeks after I wrote that letter, someone said, like, Deanne, have you ever thought about getting a table and putting it out in your own yard? And like, you don't have to go to France to do that. And I did a couple of weeks later is I, you know, took the table out of the barn and we ate supper in the yard. And you can find a lot of looking of what you're looking for where you already are. Right. And that and it took that reader to remind me of that because, you know, I'd never done that, really. I mean, here the mosquitoes are so bad most times you can't do it. Right. Sometimes I think like the world is selling us a picture of things that are, you know, so surreal and so beautiful that it is like who does get that? Oh, and if you do get it, do you get it all the time? And really, the table in my yard was really very different than what I'd seen or what I do see.
But that was, but it was bliss. It was contentment for you, right? When that table was in your yard?
It was lovely. It was lovely. It was just beautiful, really. I'll do it again.
So if I'm, if I'm seduced by that image, you know, farmhouse table in France at a chateau, or if I'm feeling envious of it, because that is certainly not my life, what am I missing out on in the real life here and now? What am I ignoring, you know, if my dreams and my vision are locked onto that sort of unattainable thing, that bliss piece of life?
See, now, that's the kind of question you end up asking yourself when you're hooking rugs, right?
Really?
That is.
Really?
Because you're sitting alone, right? And you're thinking through things and maybe you're listening to a podcast or what, you know, once in a while or whatever. Like, you're thinking through things and that is the question. And I think that's why making art and expressing yourself is so important because it takes you back to questions like, what am I missing when I'm looking for that? What am I not seeing that's right in front of me? Like, how important is an ordinary day, right? I think of that. Like, I think of sometimes a day is so ordinary, you're irritated, you know? And then I think, well, you know, I could have a medical appointment that I don't want. I could be waiting for a call that, you know? Sometimes we're missing out on our lives when we're not valuing our own yards or our own lives, our own stories, really. Our own stories are important. Our own beauty, like the beauty that's right in front of us.
There's the great Iris Murdoch quote. This is one you like. One of the secrets of a happy life is continuous small treats. So what are some of yours in the continuous small treats department? What does it for you?
A good cake of soap.
Kidding.
Like a beautiful cake of soap. I love a good cake of soap. I love food, like homemade real food, like homemade cinnamon buns or biscuit. Maybe in the winter, I love a fire or a glass of wine, like a nice glass of wine. Not five, just a couple. Like just, I love that. An apple blossom, right? Like I'm looking at my tree this year out the studio window and I'm thinking, oh, that's going to be good this year. It's not good every year, but knowing, you know, the year that it's good and I'm seeing it come. They're just small things, but like the library. I love the library. I use it all the time, you know, and now you can keep books for weeks. It's great. I have a lot of small things that I value.
I'm intrigued by something you've said about your style of making, that it's pretty far removed from perfectionism. How do you tamp that down, that perfectionistic urge? How do you sort of put it in its place and be a maker in a less striving way, if that makes any sense, in a less punishing way?
I like things to be, like if I was a carpenter, I'd like a rustic kind of style. Do you know what I mean? Like I like things to be, I like rough edges. I like things to be a little bit raw. My striving would come more in probably in business and in life sometimes than in art. I like art to be direct and raw. And when I go to make, I want immediacy, right? In the making, like I like it that hooking rugs, when I'm hooking rugs, it comes together fairly quickly. And whatever I'm feeling, I'm making it right then and it's coming out and I can see it growing, you know, like if I spend 3 hours at it, I can see it coming together. So I think it is my natural tendency that I don't tend towards perfectionism, but I do strive.
I'm certainly not in your league as a creative soul, but I
don't believe that.
It's very true. Well, okay, thank you. I do love playing around with something called paste papers. This is a technique. It's centuries old. It was used to decorate books. And I use it to make bookmarks, little bookmarks on nice, heavy paper. And the thing that floors me is how the disasters 2 days later turn out to be the most beautiful pieces. You know, when you're going back to them and doing another coat of a different color on top, the mistakes turn out to be the most beautiful thing I'm making. Do you ever find the same thing with rug hooking, that the mistakes end up being not so bad?
And I find that in life too, don't you, sometimes?
Oh, no kidding.
You know, like I do, I think, and art constantly, I think making is constantly a metaphor for life, right? Like I find the mistakes or the lines, like the rough lines, I can see exactly what you're saying, like how you'll come back to that bookmark 2 or 3 days later and you'll see things in it that you never meant to happen, but that's what you like about it, right? And that is because you were, when you are making that, you're able to let go. Like with rug hooking, we have this thing where they can pull it out and start over, right? You can just pull it out and start over. And if you were on trying to take off those layers, you never get it finished. And I always say to people, like, instead of pulling it out and starting over and pulling it out and starting over, just finish it. And when I say finish it, I mean like really finish it. Like, you know, the very last thing you do with a hooked rug is you press it with a wet cloth and you bind it, you hand sew it on the back and finish it and put it somewhere where you can look at it and see it, like hang it on a wall or put it on a floor or whatever you're going to do with it. And it's the same with your bookmarks. Like if you just leave them there and you can see what you did and you can see that sometimes your mistakes, they weren't even mistakes. They were just a place where you didn't really know what you were doing, but all that little artist in you, she just called, that all got called forward and off she went, you know.
I love this thought of the way you're coaching people who are very tempted to rip out the whole rug and start over and start over and start over and start over. There are so many parallels with things I've read about the spiritual path. You know, if you're someone who's really tempted to dip a toe into every spiritual tradition in the world and you start to dig a well and then you stop and you start to dig another well to the left and then that's not good enough so you start to dig another well to the other side of it. And so many spiritual guides will say, stop doing that. Stop pulling out the rug. Stop starting a different well every time you set out on this. Work the same well. Just go deeper in the same well and don't give up on it.
I love that. I love what you're telling me, and I think it's so true. That's exactly the same thing, I think, that we just have to go deeper. I was listening to one of your shows with Father Ron from Saskatchewan.
Oh, yeah, Ron Rolheiser.
Oh, I just loved him. I ordered his book right after. I loved what he said about post-sophistication. You get past the knowing, right? Or the thinking that you know, mm-hmm, and you get mm-hmm. to that new place and you get to that new place where you know you don't know. And I think that happens with creativity too. Like you feel like you can make it better. You feel like you can control it. You feel like you can do, and you know you can, and then you do it and you do it and you do it. And after a while, you can't even stand it anymore, right? So you go on to something else. You leave that rug behind. Like, I think we get better because we look at our mistakes. And that's true as a human being. And that's true as an artist.
I'm curious about the mystery you will sometimes explore in your writing, how you'll be out for a walk in the woods or by the sea, and by some process you don't really understand, the beauty that you're seeing all around you transforms itself into wool, to use your phrase, transforms itself into wool when you sit down and hook. How do you understand what's going on there?
I don't sometimes understand, and I sometimes see it afterwards. That happened a long time ago. I used to have a gallery in my house, and these people were coming through from Cape Breton, and they stopped in, and they were looking at this rug, and it was a man sort of sitting in a chair, and they made observations about that rug that I never put into it. You know what I mean? I wasn't thinking that that's what I was doing. They made observations about him. You know, and I started to recognize that then, but it made sense to me, and I was thinking about those things, but I never recognized it, right? Because I am a self-taught artist, like I don't have any training or education about art. So then I started noticing, like, sometimes it was after the rug was made that I could see what had happened there. Right. And so I walk every morning. I walk up the same road most days and I look into the woods. And last year when I was in Halifax in May for that graduation, there was a magnolia tree outside my window. I was nervous about giving that speech, that convocation speech, you know, not too bad, but, you know, everybody would be somewhat apprehensive. Right. Then when I look at that rug that's on the cover of my latest book, it's all this pink sort of peony magnolia, and I can see that somehow, I don't know how, but somehow I took that magnolia and made it the view of when I walk down the road every day. So I took like a really special event, right, and my ordinary daily walk, and somehow the two of them came into a rug together. And I didn't intentionally do that. Like 20 years ago I would have intentionally done that. But now I just sort of let my pen happen when I draw on the linen, and I'm working it out afterwards a lot of times, what is actually going on in that rug.
You've noticed something about your own life. I want to quote you here. Clearly, I live very differently than the way I make. And this was in the context of like feeling like a total homebody in one realm who just wants to put the kettle on and have a few oatcakes, and feeling like a total, you know, skydiver daredevil in the side of you that's an artist. Tell me about, you know, kind of that split.
I know, it's such a, like when I make rugs, it's just such an adventure. I'll take any, you know, I'll go anywhere. I'll just take my chances. But like it comes to my life, I'm quite rigid, right? You know, like if I have a pillow at a place, I'll put it back in, you know, I might walk by and just say, or I might tweak like the rock that's by my lamp. I'll just move it to the side. Like I have a rigidity about me, right? And my routine. I have a really fairly strong daily routine. I usually travel because somebody else wants me to, or because I feel some sort of pressure to, you know, and I'll go places. And sometimes I feel like I should go myself and I should see something different. So I'll go do something. So yeah, I have this, but I'm not exactly fearful, but I like routine. And in my rugs, I guess I'm afraid that I'll miss my routine. Like I miss my books and I miss my papers and I miss my wool and stuff like that. I miss my home. I get homesick really easy. I have a really strong sense of belonging, like to my home and to my art, to making. But in my rugs, I'll do whatever I like. Like I'm fearless. I have like loose edges and raw edges, and you know, I love my own rugs, like I love them, but they are not perfect. I'm not afraid to make a mistake. I'm not afraid to lose a week making a rug. I really am not. Like, I like the process of making it so much, like the thrumming and the getting lost in it, that is I figure that even if I don't get a great rug, I got that.
So that routine and rigidity that might be there in your everyday life is not there when you're sitting down to hook.
No, I wouldn't say that it is, other than that I do show up. Like, I like wool. I've tried other things. So I don't experiment with a lot of different fabrics and stuff anymore. I experiment with a lot of different wools or silks or linens. I feel like if I'm going to do it, I want to use something beautiful and something natural. Mm. Like I love that wool comes from sheep and that sheep eat the grass and that the farmer raises sheep. Like I love that, right? And so I don't really want to make polyester rugs. I want to make wool rugs. So I mean, I guess I do limit myself in some ways, but I just think that there's so much potential to make rugs that are more beautiful than the rugs I made before.
I'm really glad you mentioned the feel of wool, the where it comes from, what it looks like, what it smells like, what how it strikes you. There's something you've written about this. I gather old wool clothing from real people in real communities. What does that history bring to a finished piece once you're done with it? The fact that it's not a polyester thread from the store. This is something somebody has worn or lived with or loved.
Well, that's the way I began rug hooking. I used old clothes that were worn by people, really, and old shirts and old skirts. And then over the last few years, I haven't been able to do that as much. I still do it some, like if my husband has a wool sweater that he's getting rid of, I'll grab it. And if someone gives me wool, I'll use it now, like from their own. It's not as easy to do, but it is the tradition of rug hooking. And it is what I did in the beginning, and it is now I use a lot of yarns and a lot of new cloth. But my mother, she had a dark green wool coat before she died. That was the last coat that I remember her wearing. I cut up a piece of that coat the other day. My mother's been dead for 20 years. There's still a piece of it around. And when you hook that way, when you use the wool that your children wore, it just, I think it deepens the connection and the meaning and the math. You know, naturally, you're going to think about them more. When my father-in-law died, I kept some of his silk hankies, you know, and hooked those in a rug. The book, The Mountain and the Valley by Ernest Buckler, it's in the introduction to that book. And the woman she's hooking a rug in the introduction of that book. And she's going through her life of her children's clothes, you know, the skirt that so-and-so wore, the red sweater or, and you can just feel that it's bringing out memory for her, you know, and I think that's what it does. It's one of the things that you can do with rug hooking is that you can use recycled materials and recycled cloth. And it is a strong tradition. Like both my grandmothers hooked rugs and that's what they would have used. They wouldn't have had yarn. But as time has gone on, people are wearing less and less wool clothing, really. We don't have access to it anymore the way we used to. You can still find a little bit here and there. And that might change again. Like I'm waiting for all those merino shirts that people are buying like at Mountain Equipment Co-op. I'm waiting for those to sort of get into the secondhand market.
And then you're going to pass.
And then I'm going to pass.
You can get into that world.
Because they will make beautiful, that sort of wool jersey curls. And it makes it like every wool. Right? Every wool that you use does something different. So wool jersey, that particular wool jersey curls and it just hooks up beautifully, right?
So in that commencement speech we touched on earlier, you talked about insecurity and you essentially told the grads, don't worry about it. We all feel insecure in some way and it might even be a gift. Tell me what you mean. Where might the gift be in insecurity?
I think it makes us question ourselves, you know? Like, I think when we're too certain and we're just going straight ahead, we're not always going in the right direction, you know? So I think insecurity makes us question ourselves. And what I told them was that even if it happens in the middle of the night, because it happens that, you know, as we get older, it happens in the middle of the night. Sometime we wake up and, you know, I said, my friend sent me a note yesterday and said that she's afraid a lot. And I said, well, I'm scared sometimes too. Like, it's just part of our human condition. You know, to be uncertain. It helps us empathize and understand other people when we see it in them, you know, makes us kinder and more understanding. I just think sometimes I get on my own nerves when I'm feeling insecure.
What
right?
do you mean you
I
get
think,
on your oh, own and nerves?
I'll say to Angela who works with me, oh, yada, 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 you know, whatever, I'll be telling her some story. And I said, I know I'm just insecure and she won't disagree with me, right? That You know, like, yeah, I know I'm just insecure. And I feel like sometimes I should be more certain about things because I've been doing this, running a business and making a life for all of these years. But a lot of times I'm not certain. And I'm not sure that the people who are really certain are any happier or any better off, really.
It's such a treat.
Thank you.
Deanne Fitzpatrick is an artist whose medium is wool. She spoke to you from her studio in Amherst, Nova Scotia. This is Tapestry, keeping you company and helping you make sense of the world. If you're listening online at cbc.ca, hello to you. You can also find us on the CBC Listen app, on Spotify, on Sirius XM satellite radio, and on CBC Radio 1. I'm Mary Hines. Consider the bucket list. A quick survey of possible activities includes gaze upon the pyramids, navigate a personal underwater sub, chase a tornado, climb Mount Everest. If your bucket list is as big and bold as this, Mark Farmer would like a quiet word. Mark is here to suggest the traditional bucket list is a little overwrought. He's planning something a little more humble to celebrate his days on Earth. He calls it the Goodbye Tour.
I live right downtown in Toronto, looking over the Gardiner Expressway and the train tracks, which is about as gritty and industrial as you can get. But every once in a while, you hear a sound, and you look outside, and you realize on the 20th floor of this condo overlooking downtown Toronto is a cardinal. The songbird has lost its way and is lit in your balcony and is singing. And in some small way, I live for that sound. Also, the sound of my cat when it's really happy and it makes this weird chirp sound. And half the time, that's because it's seen the bird outside and it's getting excited. The sound of our little espresso machine on the counter once it's working and I can have my shot of coffee first thing in the morning. That's another good sound. I'll miss going to my favorite falafel joint down the street where the owner, Elias, will try to sell me an apple cake for the umpteen millionth time. I've bought one but once a year on average, but I can guarantee he's going to upsell apple cake. And I'm going to miss that strange batter we have. Things like that, you know, going to that chocolate shop and picking out the four that I know I want. You know, and they're pretty expensive. I'm not going to say this is an everyday purchase, but not being able to taste that one last time. You know, all those little things, I think those are the things I'll miss. One day, a few weeks ago, I woke up and I was looking forward to summer because there's so many things that summer unlocks. And I was thinking of all the things that I was looking forward to, getting back on my bike down in the Don Valley here in Toronto, things like that. And then I thought, well, you know what, this is sad, but one day I'm not going to wake up one summer and I'm not going to be able to look forward to those. So I thought, you know, one of the things that I'm going to miss once I'm gone. And I thought about bucket lists. My mind went to bucket lists because that's what everyone is supposed to have, the bucket list. You know, I want to go to Tahiti. I want to see Bali. I've never been to the Vatican. I've never been to the top of Empire State Building. And I thought those are great. You know, they're inspirational. And the thing they do is they take you outside yourself and your little life and they give you some perspective. But that wasn't the thing that I was thinking, wow, you know, if I'm on my final legs and I'm wondering, you know, am I going to go at this moment or that moment? I'm not going to say, God, I wish I had gone to see Machu Picchu. It's going to be, you know, I wish that I could pet my little cat one more time. I wish that I could just take the bike one more time into the Don Valley. You know, I wish I could go to my favorite chocolate shop just one more time and have one of those salted caramels. Things like that. And I thought, you know, I don't really want a bucket list. I want to do a farewell tour. And then I thought, when is that? Because you don't know when you're going. You know, maybe I'll be walking down the street and that sort of comical piano will fall on my head that you see in cartoons. You never know. So I shouldn't wait to start the farewell tour. I should start that now. This is the thing that I think some people push back on was, why can't we have both? Do you have to choose a bucket list over a farewell tour or a goodbye tour? You know, can't you do that? And I said, yeah, absolutely. You need to do those things. I'm not putting down Machu Picchu or the Empire State Building or Bali or Tahiti or anywhere because they're great. They're fantastic. They're huge. But part of that is they get to see what's really important. And the things that are the most important, they're not necessarily the big swooshes in life. I think that they're the smaller things, but those small things, they happen every day. And, you know, that repetition, that familiarity, it makes them building blocks for what's important in life. So it's kind of like if I'm on my final legs and I'm thinking, you know, what do I wish I could do? The big things, they're sort of like celebrities. They're big and flashy and impressive. But you know what? I don't think anyone really wants to see a celebrity as they're exiting. No one goes, God, I wish I could see George Clooney right now. I think they want to see their wife, their husband, their kids, their cat. I think they want to do those small things that, you know, really have wormed their way into their heart. And that's kind of how I feel about it. If you have a TikTok account, or Instagram for that matter, you've seen no lack of influencers who are posing in front of fancy restaurant, you know, exotic scene, ruined temple, nightclub. And half the time they're throwing fish lips in the photo. And this is sort of what our culture is doing, is fetishizing the transient. It's fetishizing, you know, the big thing, the thing that the influencer is doing, the exotic location, the expensive restaurant, la 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 la. And the more we go down that path, the more we get away from what I think, in my humble opinion, is important, like those little things. I know people that have Parkinson's. I know people that have ALS. I know people that have lupus. And here's an example. So my dad is elderly, and I'm from the East Coast. I'm from Halifax. We used to go fishing all the time. We used to go down to the government wharf on St. Margaret's Bay, drop a line in, see if we could get some mackerel on a good day, or if not, get just some sculpin or perch or whatever there was. And we hadn't gone in a long time, so I kept asking him, look, you know, we should go fishing, let's go fishing. And his response is, I'm busy, you know, another time. And I kept asking, and I kept getting pushed away. And then, you know, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And now, Dad, on a good day, can get around the block. So I'm not going fishing with Dad ever again. That makes me think. If you're like me and you think that those little things are more heartfelt and more essential, you know, what was written in The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry? The most important things in life are those that cannot be seen. You basically feel them with your heart. I remember reading at least a couple of articles with people who were on their deathbeds about, you know, the regrets of the dying. And there were things like, you know, having the courage to live the life that you wanted as opposed to the one that people told you to live. It was about having the courage to, you know, express your true feelings. It was about staying close with friends. It was about, you know, doing work that you enjoyed or maybe even loved, at least liked. Things like that. So when I think about, you know, my farewell tour, my goodbye tour, I'm keeping that stuff in mind. And I think that if I can stay true to that and some of those things, then I'll be in good shape.
Mark Farmer is from Halifax. He lives and works in Toronto. You can find Mark's writing in the Globe and Mail, including his piece on the Goodbye Tour. That's it for us this week. This episode was produced by Arman Egbali, Theo Van Buzekom, and Samir Chabra. Technical production by Laura Antonelli and Sam McNulty. The senior producer is Rosie Fernandez. I'm Mary Hines. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.